Welcome to the Fargo Podcast, the officially unofficial podcast for Fargo on FX. I'm Jim.
I'm Aaron.
And today we're talking about Season 4, Episode 10, Happy. Aaron, are you happy with this episode?
I'm tolerably okay.
I mean, oh, boy. You're the Leon okay. of this episode?
No. I'm trying to be apologetic because I do feel like that this is kind of... you know, another one of them divisive seasons of some of the television that we watch where it's like, you know, people start balkanizing. I'm seeing in the forum, not the forums, but in the Reddit, like people, like if there's well-meaning people want to discuss their issues and problems with some of the messiness of the season, they're starting to be shouted down. The people that are praising are starting to get, you know, downvoted comments shitting all over like every aspect of it. So I want to take a step back and say that, like, I think that this season of Fargo is messy. It's doing a lot of really heavy lifting over a huge cast of characters, some big, bold ideas. And I always want to support filmmakers when they're swinging for the fences. And I think Holly was doing so in this season. However, between the shutdown and him deciding to, you know, try to steal scenes from three or four other episodes to make a middle episode for some pacing reason, for him kind of like jettisoning the plot to go for a really big bravura, you know, artistic showpiece last episode, I do think this season feels a little bit more stitched together and piecemeal. And it's done violence to some of the main characters, like Ethelreda has been lost for 3 weeks.
Yeah.
And she's in here almost as a deus ex machina to, like, you know, resolve everything in a finale episode that's not even 40 minutes long next week, according to the advanced runtime. So I hear it. Like, this is not your father's Fargo. This isn't even like peak Holly Fargo. This isn't even last season Fargo, which already ruffled a lot of feathers. And it's dealing with a lot of important shit that's borderline offensive or upsetting to a lot of people. Having said that, I actually like this episode a lot. I think this episode could have been a subtitle. Aaron is right about everything he's been saying this season. Like, Jesus Christ, here comes the ring back to significance. Mr. Snowman is a guardian spirit, not a spooky, spooky ghost that's tormenting. He's a blessing, not a curse. There's, the bumbling brothers kind of sort of pay off in a hilarious moment of like Fargo serendipity.
The guy who thinks he's the brains of the operation, you know, or wants to be, is coming back into play as that. Yeah.
Yep. I actually thought all this stuff felt like it was coming together. And I am like, the one thing is like, man, 39 minutes with credits next episode. That's what it's going to take to wrap this plot up. That seems wild, but I believe and I really like this episode. Jim, what do you think?
Yeah. I think I would have started getting a little more antsy. Like, I think this season has been hit miss, certainly. And I would have really started getting antsy after last week's episode if it wasn't this, you know, Wizard of Oz, like, kind of jaunt off, like an excursion into another world. That kind of postponed my really, like, getting antsy. This episode, it does everything it needs to do, but for some reason this isn't hitting with me. And I'm like, look, I'm the son of an Italian American. I am an Italian American. Like, this should be right up my alley. I should be really enjoying this stuff, and this season should be firing on all cylinders for me. It's not really doing it. Like, I'm enjoying some of the characters more as we get deeper into it, and I get more comfortable with him. Damn, we're almost at the end of this thing, right? And I'm still not feeling like it's come together in a super satisfying way. And I think it started with that, you know, run like 6 and 7 or what was it? Was it 6 and 7 where we think the episodes were cut from like one long one and like some footage was added and stuff? That's where I started to be like, okay, this season has not been super exciting, but it should be getting exciting right now. Like, now's the time if it's going to. And it just didn't happen for me, and it didn't come together. It didn't mesh like so many of these other seasons have. So I don't know, man. I'm not really feeling it. It's fine, but you know, it's not the Fargo of yesteryear for me.
Well, I do remember, I want to have a discussion about some meta stuff here. I do remember, like, when we're, you know, Monday morning, we get together and we start writing the promos for the week, you know, like our housekeeping and, like, you know, getting people, like, excited about all of our different shows. And we had this running joke on Fargo where it's like,
yeah,
the Midwestern gang war is heating up on Fargo. And I do think it's funny that, like, in the penultimate episode, when you are reasonably, okay, we've dealt with all this stuff, we've had all the, you know, the Duke... Archduke Ferdinand has now been assassinated in his motor car. Like, it's time for the fucking war. We Godfather style yada yada through it with the musical pop. It's literally the Godfather technique of, like, let's show all the different photos of the massacre and the official response and the outrage with a bunch of tough dudes walking around with Tommy guns and piles of bodies and black and white photos and the flashbulb effects. And, you know, now we're 29 soldiers deep in the war on the cannon side. Who knows what's going on the FATA side? And it did feel like, I don't know, but the other thing is, like, we entirely by accident fell down, like, a gangster hole this year where, you know, we had a whole bunch of anniversaries and we like to do things around movie anniversaries, and, like, the anniversary of Goodfellas and Casino came up, and we also looked at The Irishman at the, like, to get this year started. There's tons of really great gangster movies that we've watched, and I feel like that Noah Hawley tried to make kind of like that unironic kind of like Godfather versus American Gangster, and it seems really, really exciting, but he doesn't quite have his hands around everything going on in the story and in the plot and the characters. And, like, today, this episode's a perfect example. He skips forward 4 months because he wants to yada yada through the gang war. That sounds like expensive set piece after expensive set piece to shoot and write and orchestrate. And that works on a lot of these plots, but it also raises a lot of questions about Miss Mayflower. Like, what the fuck has she been doing for 3-4 months? Like, she was perched on her revenge plot last month. Everything was coming down. So now we have to have Dr. Harvard in this, like, fugue state for 4 months. And she has to just be living in an apartment, plotting revenge, but not do, like, this very day, 4 months later, she decides to stomp over and start shit with it. None of that makes sense.
And on the gang war side, you've got New York, who 4 months ago said, hey, wrap this up in 2 weeks. That's all we're giving you.
Right.
Now we're here 4 months later. And I don't know if Joe Bulow and Ebel were able to, like, broker some kind of sustained support from New York or what, but they don't even address any of that. Right. It's like 4 months later after a 2 week deadline, they're still going at it. So
I think it's going to be a little commentary of, but there again is, do you need, like, my best guess is this is kind of commentary on, like, Vietnam War and, like, proxy war. You know, that's been, like, one of the 17 things he's tried to commentary about, like, these cold wars that you get into. And it's like, you know, France is over there in Vietnam, like, sacre bleu, we're losing control of a colony, it's falling to communist America, help us out. We're like, okay, fine, we're going to send some fucking military advisors and help you sort this shit out. 10 years later, you know, six figures of Americans are dying in this country for, why are we? Because the French asked us for in the 50s for help controlling this colony. Like, there is some interesting, like, you know, because Happy gets here today, you know, from the country, another region, no, totally disconnected war. Why is he getting into it? Because we're kind of all in a gang, and where one of our fortunes go, all of our fortunes go. It's like that commentary is all there. And he's like, we're only going to be here for 2 weeks. Am I supposed to? Is that like a deliberate callback to New York's 2 weeks? And now it's like, this is another Cold War. This is a Vietnam situation. But what is a parable about Vietnam doing in the middle of Fargo season 4 when it's an immigrant story about, I mean, like I said, I can get in my car and drive down that road and meet Holly at that destination. But I get there and like, why the fuck did you call me out here to Vietnam? Uh-huh. You know? And I think that's it. Like, all of those storylines we've talked about are very ambitious, deserving of a 13 episode arc of their own, and we got like six or seven of those all going in. You know, the plight of black people in America, the plight of immigrants in America, which is essentially everyone except for the First Nations people.
Yeah.
Right. The First Nations people are in there, with representation as plot, like Catholic Americans versus Protestant Americans versus, you know, American Protestants like the Mormons. It's almost overstuffed, you know, like at what point does the Oreo factory go broke when they're like double stuff, triple stuff, quadruple stuff, 10 times stuff? If it's like your whole row of Oreos is just one Oreo with two cookies and it's like 6 inches of cream in between it. Like, it's too stuffed, right?
Sure.
And I think that's the argument. And like, I guess, like I said, I can meet him at all the different destinations and be like, yeah, this is cool, this is worth saying, but like, maybe if he had the season back, he would maybe not go for some of the Cold War analysis on top of. But I felt like, and I get it, like sometimes when I'm sitting there writing over on Swizzbold, the three right turns, like there is this temptation to like throw a grand unified theory on everything wrong. And like if you get this one thing and if people can understand this one thing about America, then it can change. And I think Holly kind of maybe got seduced by that.
Yeah, and if you look at it, like the gang war, heating up for the last 6 weeks or whatever, right. You know, that's been a running joke, but it's been true of the show, and it's been a series of subversions just keeping that thing from ever feeling, even though things are moving forward, the progress is being made on that front, it doesn't feel like it. It doesn't feel like this is the moment where it kicked off. It's like, this is the moment where you got a gangster who's extra pissed. And he's still going to be in the shadows, not doing much about it other than like playing these games. It just didn't feel like you ever got to the point where it boiled over. It was just boiling forever. Yeah. And every time, you know, you had the pot about to boil over, you'd have some character do something that would undercut it, right? Like, you know, Wef's going to go in and he's going to get he's going to do whatever at the cannon house, or, you know, Kalamita's going to go to the cannon house. He's going to kill everybody there. No. He just goes up and talks to the wife and she scares him off.
Right.
All these subversions of the action that should have progressed just kept happening and kept me from really ever engaging on the level I think they wanted me to.
Do you think to what extent did the shutdown lead to this season's messiness? Because there's two schools of thought there. One, the shutdown gives you suddenly time to like really refine, you know. I guess there's like a couple episodes left to shot, a lot of post-production left to do, and it's like, man, we could do some maybe reshoots and some pickups. And I you know, obviously the temptation was there, and he created a whole new episode out of whole cloth. I wonder if that, I don't know, because none of that has anything to do with, I think, my main criticisms, which is the too stuffed Oreo. There's like just way too much things that you're trying to comment on for any of it to feel coherent. But, you know, I don't know, because the other argument is, boy, you should have that time to like really smooth things out, and like, it, you know, maybe things were rough in the beginning, but the end should be smooth as silk. I don't feel like, I feel like the first five episodes of Fargo were much more of a piece and felt much more locked in and dialed in than the back half.
Yeah, I agree. I don't know if that is a direct result of the shutdown, but I know that you could certainly, you know, a time can be a blessing and a curse. I think the more restrictions you have, the more creative you have to get to work within those restrictions, and time can be one of those restrictions.
Sure.
And sometimes that leads to a much better outcome, a much tighter product, because you have to cut things, you know, you can't indulge yourself. Whereas if you're given an extra amount of time to go back and make rewrites to a thing that was already pretty set in stone, well, now suddenly you've got to re-engage with all those pieces. You run the risk of then indulging too much. And I can't say whether that happened or not, whether this would be a better or worse season without the shutdown, because obviously we had the shutdown. But I don't know. It does feel like something is not connecting here.
I am very excited after next week to read the, you know, the postmortems that they usually, you know, like, I'm sure Holly's going to be interviewed by Alan Sepinwall or Pani Wozniak or some of these guys. Mo Ryan. Okay. Somebody's going to get him on an interview, and he's going to spill the beans about like the structure of this season, because it also, you know, he's had like years to come up with like mm-hmm. what he wanted to say about Fargo, and I bet it's going to be interesting. And who knows, like, you know, next 39 minutes might, like, I don't think anything the next 39 minutes is going to make this season a disaster for me. I think it's a good season of Fargo. It's kind of like that thing where it's like, man, I was listening to this speaker for like the first 15 minutes and then the last 5 minutes, I'm like, ooh, boy, I'm losing it a little bit. I'm rooting for you, guy, and I'm liking what you're saying, but like, you need to kind of like be able to put a point on all this stuff. And
yeah, for me, this season is fitting into the gigantic chasm of okay television between like The Walking Dead and Breaking Bad / Leftovers, that kind of stuff. Like, right. There's a monumental, enormous chasm between those two, and most of television slots in there, this does too. It's not awful. It's not great. It's somewhere in the middle, and honestly, it's less interesting because of that. Like, it almost would be more interesting to me to come on here every week and rip into what a shitty season of Fargo it is.
Sure.
At least that'd be fun, you know? This stuff where you're stuck in the middle is like, okay, it's fine.
Here are the highlights coming up this week on Bald Move.
House of the Dragon Season 2 is coming up sooner than you think. And to get us all back in that Leal state of mind, Aaron and I have teamed up with Maester Anthony to bring you coordinated coverage, new and old. For the next 10 weeks leading up to Season 2, Maester Anthony will be releasing an episode of his Season 1 coverage on the Hot D podcast. He originally recorded and released it exclusively on his Double Dragon podcast, so while it's retro coverage, it's almost certainly new to you.
In addition, each Friday, Jim and I will be reading the relevant sections of George Martin's Targaryen history book, Fire and Blood, so that we can compare and contrast it to that week's episode of Hot D Season 1. So grab a copy of Fire and Blood and read along with us if you're so inclined. Just don't read ahead unless you enjoy spoilers.
If that's not enough to satisfy your craving for fantasy entertainment, well, you're in luck. We recently watched King Arthur, Legend of the Sword, which is Guy Ritchie's uniquely stylish and anachronistic riff on the King Arthur legend. Yes, Guy Ritchie took on the most famous of all English legends and did it with huge ambitions. Sadly, or perhaps thankfully, depending on your tastes, his ambitions were cut short by meager audience interest. Join us for the podcast this Tuesday as we discuss why that might have been and whether this retelling is any good.
You can find these and many other great podcasts by searching for Bald Move Pulp or Bald Move Prestige in your favorite podcast app. We're about 10 weeks out from House of the Dragon Season 2, and it's time to prepare for war.
Which in our case means, watching a lot of Hot D and reading a lot of Fire and Blood.
Each week between now and June 16th, Maester Anthony and his co-host Steve are hosting a watch of each episode of Hot D Season 1. And then me and Jim are going to host a discussion of the differences between the events on that episode and how they're recounted in George R. R. Martin's historical tome, Fire and Blood.
That's right, I've resorted to reading dragon books. God help us all. We'll see if my fresh eyes add any new insights or predictions into Season 2.
Arm yourselves with all the lore you can for the battles ahead. House of the Dragon returns June 16th, but we've got you covered until then.
Check out all of our upcoming Hot D coverage on the Hot D feed or on Bald Move Pulp, available wherever you listen to podcasts.
Well, maybe we should talk about this episode in detail. Unlike last episode, I've broken it back down into the various factions' business. We do have the time skip of 4 months, because like I think people might have missed that contextually, that we are now past the new year. These events now take place in 1951, 1950. Yeah. We're in the spring. The snow has melted. It's starting to get nice out. So we joined the cannon business. They've been fighting for 4 months. Loy is no longer in his home. Mm-hmm. He is now living in like the penthouse suite of whatever you call a high rise in 1951 Kansas City, a medium rise.
Is that the Gadfly? Is that where he's at?
I didn't see the name of the building, but it's a nice hotel. He's Al Caponing it. living in the penthouse of this hotel.
Yeah.
His wife's getting him all cleaned up for an interview he's given with this happy guy who has been mentioned literally all season long. This is Leon's cousin. You know, when Loy was giving this man a savage beating with a belt, you know, his men were screaming, "You can't do this. We're going to need Hap before all this is over." Well, they need Hap. He's here. Apparently Buell's mother was best friends with his mother, and they're like sisters, which I don't think means they're actually sisters, but there's a long, long tie to this family, time together, and it's brought him to the table. He's very country, and you can see that in the way he dresses in comparison to, like, Loy. His rap sheet, you know, because he's introduced just like all the other criminal dudes this season. He's got the old timey booking and rap sheet. His primary crime was cattle rustling, you know, just to give a context and a contrast between the two. He's very reluctant to lend his strength to Loy because he sees Loy as a losing cause, and
not even that, he sees Loy more as like giving all black folk a bad name, right?
Yeah, or drawing attention, because he's like, you know, the only thing worse than living in darkness is stepping out into the light, because when the cops bust heads, they don't care about which heads, they just care about the color.
Yeah.
And, you know, Loy's retort is the natural one, so like, what, you stay in the shadows the whole time? No one sticks their head out into the light? You know, the difference of like minding your forefathers and your place and, you know, versus making a name for yourself and doing things like in a new flashy kind of way. Buell's able to essentially pull the cousin, the family thing on. And I like Happy's retort about like, yeah, I got a cousin on death row too. You want me to sit in a chair with him when they flip on the electricity? But they point out the fact that New York is stretched thin. They don't want this war. No one can fight it. They just need a little bit more strength. So he agrees to the 2 weeks, the same 2 week deal that the FAD has got 4 months ago.
Which makes me think that they're trying to say something with that. Like, are they trying to say that this is a thing that goes on forever? Like that time is meaningless, right? It's like, you know, with the season having these themes of change, right? And how you roll with it or you get steamrolled by it. Are they trying to say like there are some things that are not changing, and the more they change, the more they stay the same? Like this gang war lasting quote unquote 2 weeks has now stretched out into 4 months, and then we have another character saying 2 weeks. That's supposed to imply that this is going to stretch on much, much longer.
Yeah, I really think this is just a broad gesture towards the Cold War status quo that, you know, everyone goes into these things like, is it really a war? Or is it a police action? You know, like and yet you get in there and it's a decade later and, you know, 78,000, 80,000, 90,000 Americans are dying. Well, now, like, would you going to quit now?
Right.
Well, I mean, what do you say to those people's families?
Like,
you know, there's like, this has been pointed out by smarter people than me that there are people now going into Afghanistan and Iraq who were not born during 9/11. There are fathers passing down their patrols and their forward operating bases to their sons and daughters that are going and occupying. It's you know, like, there's broadly speaking, we still have tanks and troops in Germany. We still have tanks and troops in North Korea, or I'm sorry, South Korea.
Yeah.
We tend to get stuck in these entanglements. Now, why does that point need to be made? I think it's like, if I put my, you know, Noah Hawley hat on, he's making an analogy to like essentially race war in America.
Exactly.
Yeah. Like one side has to be a side that, like, you know what, I'm going to swallow an escalation or an affront or an attack, and I'm just not going to react this time. Mm-hmm. Whichever side has, you know, and what side is the one that can absorb that? Which side's got the strength? What side's like, you know? But that's what it takes—not just once, but several times—to get the fight. You know, you either have to win the war decisively. And what does that even look like when it turns to like, what does it mean to be an American in America? or one side has to just start absorbing shots and just not reacting. But that's a hard thing to do. Look at the Middle East, look at racial relations in America, look at our various entanglements around the world. Yeah, you first, right, is the response to that. So
sure. You got this lurch motherfucker in the background holding two pictures of Happy's ancestors.
Sure, yeah.
Which, you know, gives further context for the amount of time. I mean, if you needed it, like hundreds of years, mm-hmm. right, in this country.
Yeah.
It goes back further than that, even.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, they're definitely pulling something with that. It feels silly to me, and not in the Fargo silly kind of way, like Gaetano's death is, but like just straight up silly to have this guy standing in the background holding these pictures. Like, do you need that? It just feels so artificial.
I have noticed in the last few years as, like, you know, there's a lot of commentary about, like, you know, black folk and how they feel about, you know, their culture and their families and how it's different fundamentally from, like, white Protestants in America. Hollywood's really leaned into that. You know, you see, like, you know, Black Panther, you know, he goes to visit his ancestors on their ancestral Africa tree, and talks to all the other Black Panthers, including his father. And you see that, in this election, a lot of Black politicians were talking about, you know, the important, like, name checking their ancestors and stuff. I just feel like this is like, it's something culturally important, but it's also in the cultural milieu now, and that can be a really dangerous combination of offensiveness. But I do think that, like,
if those politicians had lurch behind them standing with two of their family ancestors, photos.
Give it 20 years, man. These are pulling from real kind of things and real relationships people have. Oh God, I will say that, like, I do think that, like, fundamentally looking at ancestors for answers for things, like, it's, you know, it's strength and inspiration. Like, that does feel like a fundamentally conservative position. You know, anytime you anytime you're looking backwards instead of forwards, and, you know, this could very well be super offensive observation to make, but I do wonder that, because, like, when I was thinking about Happy and he grabs the pictures and he looks at, like, father and I'm looking at grandfather. What the fuck? And what the fuck is he actually doing? He's just having, like, he's having a discussion within his own mind about what should happen. And I'm putting on my secular hat here. Like, I don't actually believe ancestors are alive and conscious and all that kind of stuff. Okay.
Right.
This is the same way, like, when a preacher gets on a stand and says, God told me to do this. Like, how can you fact check that? It's a way to, like, buttress a single person decision with a veneer of extra respectability, citing the Bible, citing ancestors, citing the America's founding fathers. You know, those are ways you do that. And
that's why I think it feels artificial. It's just, you know, it's there as a visual. But
tell that to a preacher on the pulpit or who's running for Congress that, like, yay, this God shit. What is this artificial?
I totally would, because, like, I don't believe
you're right,
in that.
And where would it get you? Probably nowhere. ran out of the hall a lot of places, ran out of town. So, like, Absolutely. Anyway, I think there's more to the canon business, but this is the crux of theirs, and it kind of all melds together in a Sputnik business later. So, the one thing is, this is at his low point. You know, we had the Nadir. We're at the Nadir now. He is openly questioning his own worth as a man. Whether his best days are behind him, whether he can win this war at all. He's thinking about his boy that he's lost. He's thinking about how strong his wife is and how much he's disappointed her. You know, he's lost his cops. He's lost everything at this point. He's about to get something important. Let's talk about the Fadas. We enter the Fada business with Evil talking to Joe Bulow. Now, if people came in season four blind, the only thing you need to know about Joe Bulow is he'll eventually be the manager of the northern acquisition of the Kansas City Mafia, moving in on the Fargo gang. Like, this Kansas City thing, that whatever happens at the end of this season, it's so fucking successful that it starts the octopus in the 70s and start muscling in on other regional powers. and see season two of Fargo if you want to know more about that. Then watch season one and then go back and watch season three. I think that's the way I would do it, just to get the chronology right. I thought it was interesting that Gaetano is kind of the voice of reason in these scenes. Like, you know, Josto's popping off and, you know, making this all personal. He's like, hey, this is just about business, which gives him the idea that what you really need to do is take this Loy Cannon fellow and just supplant him with someone a little bit easier to get along with. Smash this cut is to Leon and Happy.
Yeah, for sure. Which I kind of, you know, saw coming when they said they need somebody weak who thinks he's strong. I'm like, oh, that's Leon to a T. It's been him all season. Does that feel weird to you? Does it feel like over the course of the last, well, I would say the last two episodes, but there's that Wizard of Oz episode in there that has nothing to do with anything else in the gang war. Does it feel weird to you over the last two episodes they've made Gaetano into a bit of the brains and the brawn, and Josto is like this buffoon who's flailing wildly?
I can't tell whether I'm in the tank for Fargo, because like I've kind of like really been thinking about Gaetano and his multi layers of like trauma and abuse, and like this is a big puzzle piece. Like I don't, I think he's like a real melting pot of a character. Like he's got this like very tough upbringing, and you know, like he's physically strong and he's capable of a lot of violence, and he was put in positions where violence was like glorified. But he's also a case of arrested development. He literally, in a lot of ways, is literally that 11-year-old boy trapped in this giant, you know, powerful body. And I think that's why he can sometimes be defeated and afraid and fearful. And sometimes he can be impulsive and brash and win. And sometimes he can trip and fucking blow his brains out. Like, I kind of come full, like, I don't think this is a great way to tell this story and have this character be respected. But I'm willing to kind of go along with it well enough to like, I think I know what Holly's doing and he's doing a pretty good job of doing what I think he's doing. But that's not a great way. It's a high risk, low reward way to tell a story about a character, I think.
Yeah, I've just been hot and cold with Gaetano. I think occasionally there are moments of brilliance with that character, the writing of that character. And I think a lot of the times it's just this character is whatever they need him to be in the moment. Whether he's super smart and observant and can help strategize, or whether he's an extremely violent person who's confident in his physical abilities, or whether he's a mouse who's afraid and cowering in the corner. It's a mess in my opinion. That character is a mess. Although I will say that scene in the car that we're going to get later with them, with him and Josto, I really liked. And there are moments like that. I fucking love his opera dance when he goes into that little cafe, you know, and slips on the ice and kids laughing at him. I love all that stuff, but like that character feels gloriously, like
this basic clumsiness. Well, speaking of messes, like what do we have to think about Happy? Because, like, if we take him at his word, you know, he's someone that reveres family and his ancestors, and you shouldn't jump up and get too high above your station. Yet, he goes in and puts his cousin in Loy's place and says, like, essentially, I want everything that I'm saying that Loy is essentially too big for his britches to get. I want for my cousin, who I acknowledge is a dumbass. Like,
yeah.
Happy seems like a complete opportunistic hypocrite, that he will take the language of, you know, like, oh, there's our ancestors and oh, family and oh, we have to do everything as a community and we can't, you know, got to do. And then what's the commentary behind these guys playing the, honestly, it's the role of the useful fool for the Fadas. I don't know who this is aimed at, to tell you the truth.
Sure. I think there's definitely an element of hypocrisy in that, certainly. The other thing is, I guess I'm questioning who he sees as family. Like, does he actually see the Cannons as family, or is it Leon that he sees as family, who's his actual real cousin, you know?
That is real family. And, like, you know, is that a strength to prioritize actual blood over...
I don't...
like.
I don't think so. I'm a bit more of a meritocratist.
Similarities in ideology, in goals and aims and capabilities. Is that what you draw, or is it just around family? And, you know, that a lot of difference in who you talk to and where you go on that. But I thought
loyalty
is definitely a strength, though.
Like, I don't want to discount loyalty, right? And if family is the group that you've chosen to settle on, that loyalty is important, certainly.
Yeah. And what would this guy's, you know, sharecropper and slave ancestors think about selling out, you know, your, if not cousin, your, you know, BFF, your mom's BFF to some Italian gangster outfit?
Sure.
Yeah. And what does that mean about the war in Vietnam? I don't know.
And can you blame him, like, for this hypocrisy when Loy is out there giving away his children as instruments of business, you know, like...
And as Happy's trying to make the deal, you got the mayor, the alderman, father-in-law. Apparently, he's lost his election because he's still an alderman, and now he's all pissed off, and he's got this gang war that he's probably getting tarnished with. And, you know, like, what's it look like to Happy when this guy busts in and, like, breaks up your meeting? Like, you're still, you know, like, I'd almost wonder if this is another, like, intentional double agent double cross, like a Luca Brasi situation. Like, go over there and tell them you're not so happy with the family and kind of see what shakes out. Except for this at season of Fargo, every single time I've thought, oh, Loy's got this master fucking plan, it's always been the text. Oh, it's just the Fargo guys he's got guns for.
And
oh,
then the last scene wouldn't mean nearly as much, right? When Ethelreda comes to him and gives him the solution to his problems.
Exactly.
It would just be like, oh, well, I've already got a plan in place, little girl. I don't need your help.
Exactly. So, like, I kind of, like, you know, with perhaps 40 minutes left of the season to go, I'm out of master super double cross fifth dimensional Loy Cannon chess moves. We'll see, though.
Yeah.
But I don't know, like, this father, he gets punched by Gaetano real twice. This is another interesting case where it's like, I think Holly is throw this scene in just to show, like, as the Italians are offensive to the black folk, this white Protestant American is super offensive to the Italians, essentially talks to them about in the same way, treats them as less than, orders them like, you know, it's again the story of what it means to be an America and American in America. I did like the line about, I'm going to walk away from you like a fart in an elevator.
Because that's what you are.
Pretty good. I've gotten some, say what you will about Fargo, I've gotten some good expressions I'm keeping in my back pocket. Off the Cob, super solid hit. Walk away from you like a fart in an elevator. That's a particular emotional palette that's tricky to paint with, and I like it. Mm-hmm. So Josto and G, like, everybody's gunning for Wef. You know, Loy's looking out for him. He's not, you know, his men are saying he's not going to live to see another day. The Italian mob, like, he's, this is exactly what Weffy or Deffy was warning him about. Yeah. You know, like, you try to butter this toast on all the sides and you get up to three sides, it's just not going to work, you know, Palomino. And then this is the scene that you were alluding to about the brothers, you know, Gaetano letting his guard down around Josto and explaining, like, you know, how he got exiled and how that affected him and how he feels so lost and alone. And the brothers are able to bond over that. It's a pretty sweet, but, like, kind of also hopeless scene in context of what happens immediately after. But you said you liked it. What you like about the scene?
Oh, I like that. I don't need every scene that I enjoy and I think is well acted and well written to be a positive scene. I think this is a scene describing trauma, a scene describing sadness in a way, but it worked for me. And I guess, you know, I don't expect a lot from the character of Gaetano. And when he does show a little bit of vulnerability here, a little bit of, you know, that brotherly connection that he's supposed to have with Josto, I think there's a lot there that a lot to enjoy. Like, it's a sad scene, but a very well written and acted scene.
Agreed.
And there are a couple of moments where it's funny too, you know, like the confusion we get from Gaetano. Mm-hmm. It's
big like a pickle. Like he's like, yeah, I'm not talking different scale. I'm saying big like bull. You're big like a Vlasic. Okay, and he almost got derailed in the middle of the story on that. I mean, man, that's the thing. Like Fargo this season has been like haymaker punchlines thrown from the unlikeliest of positions. You know, the fart attack. We got the dick joke in the middle of these brothers bonding over like this just terrible trauma, like, you know, childhood trauma. I'm thinking like, you know, it even goes back further. It's like an 11-year-old having sex. Like, over-sexualization of children. Like Holly's going after cuties. This is season two. My God, there's the 18th issue he's tackling. It's all interesting, but it also has that like, yeah, the comic relief to it. Which, you know, that's a Fargo thing for sure. Let's move on to the police business. We got Detective Weff fighting for his life. Has he really flipped over a new leaf here, or has this him like following the path of least resistance to the fact that now everybody wants him dead? And like, if you, no one on the police department's too fond of him either. That's what I got from this episode. His police chief being like, yeah, you better watch your back. And the way that is like the, you know, they got a police escort on this guy to protect him, I guess. Mm-hmm. It is weird with the 4-month time jump of him playing, you know, beating on both sides, because he just shuts down the Josto's, you know, main place. And with the context, you're pretty sure he's done that with Loy, too, because Loy's not living in any of his places anymore. 4 months of doing that, you'd think he'd have been dead a long time ago.
But yeah, you're not wrong.
He's still living in his apartment. He's got his Alpine Shepherd boys. It took 4 months before they decided, you know what? We know where this guy lives. Let's just fucking hit him.
Yeah, I hadn't even thought about that. That's another of the stretches with the 4 month.
His
break.
Car could get like wired for a bomb. There's so many vulnerabilities. He's not even driving it anymore. That's what I thought this was going for, that he was going to run out. I left him surprised, boss. Like, your surprise is you busted up his Hummel figurines?
Mm-hmm.
No wonder you're losing the gang war, man. This is not how you send a message. I fucking wrecked his porcelain dolls, boss. You should see it. Although, I guess, burning the eye sockets out of his dead fiance's shrine picture.
Yeah, that's the horse head, right, in the bed.
That's pretty horrific. He comes home. His apartment's been tossed. He goes to leave. Gaetano and Josto are waiting for him personally because... honestly, this is why this is so fucking messy.
Yeah.
Like, the heads of the mafia bosses should never be staking out a place at night.
You never saw Don Vito out there staking somebody out, right? Planning to kill them. He's not riding along for the hits. No.
Especially when you know there's two other factions that know where this guy lives and wants him dead, too. Like, I was expecting, like, honestly, when I was watching this, I wasn't ready for what was happening because I was thinking, okay, Weff's going to get car bombed. If that doesn't hit, then, like, Loy's group is going to come up and just wax these Fada brothers for exposing themselves in the middle of the night with no cover, like, making these giant tactical, but none of that happens. What does happen is... you know, Weff gets home, he goes outside, and none of the things we thought were going to happen, like this escalation of the little Indian song that he was going to overcome his weakness here. Like, he essentially succumbs to his mountain of ticks. He fumble fucks his gun, he fumble fucks getting out of the car, and his fiance sings him to sleep, and he passively accepts his death, and then beyond the grave laughs at the irony of Gaetano blowing his own head off.
Mm-hmm.
You know, trigger discipline, kids. You don't want to fuck around with it, especially when you got winter gloves on. You don't want to be walking around with your finger in that trigger. Look what happens.
I mean,
four rules of firearm safety. They're there for a reason, everybody. How much do we want to talk about Gaetano blowing his brains out? It was one of those classic tragicomical things that happened in Fargo.
Yeah, and it seems like I wonder if any tragedy would ever befall the Fadas if it weren't for accidents and happenstance, right? Because like Donatello died the exact same way.
Yeah, farting himself to death.
Yeah, he farted, but then the BB gun is like the freak accident that you know, just hit him in the neck. They rush him to the hospital. Just he the ends right up spot. In the wrong hospital. Giusto says the wrong thing to the wrong person, and boom, he's dead. Like,
yeah. Oh, you're right. It was a cascading series of failures.
Absolutely, yeah. From all parties. So, like, I wonder if anything bad ever happens to them. The universe almost seems like it's conspiring against them in a way.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, it's like in there, it's like, how does that help the narrative of the season? Because it'd be one thing if the Fadas are seeing as bumblefuck, but they're the benefactors of privilege, so they keep falling upwards. But like, this seems like without Loy doing anything, that he has almost turned the tide of the war just from their ill fortune.
Yeah.
Which I guess that's what happened in the beginning of the season too. So,
mm-hmm.
The rare moment where I felt like I didn't see this coming at all. I was very confident we would never see Satchel again. We do see Satchel a couple times. Satchel has been, you know, this sweet little boy has been living in the wind, on the plains of America through the harsh winter. It gets fucking cold on that Kansas plain. He's just been living out, stealing milk off of porches, maybe living with, but I honestly don't know, and the show doesn't care to let me know. But his experiences have made him hard. They make that clear. And when some rednecks pull up, I was starting to get, you know, I see this kind of like drunken red, you know, truck weaving in the roads towards them. I'm like, oh, Jesus Christ, it's Lovecraft country all over again.
Yeah.
But he flips the script and takes it straight Mike Milligan and makes it clear that he's not putting up with their bullshit. But still, I don't know what to do with that, because in 1951's Kansas, I believe those rednecks just go to the nearest sheriff department and say, we got a colored boy waving a gun and menacing us fine white folks, and we'll never hear from Mike Milligan / Satchel again.
Yeah, this seems like a loose end of a plot that I didn't even know needed to be there. Like, I saw him tuck that gun into his belt and I thought Mike Milligan is here, and I didn't need anything else to tell me that. And yet here we are watching a scene that has a sort of natural follow on of what's going to happen next. And if it doesn't happen, I'll be a little surprised in a disappointed kind of way.
Yeah.
But if it does happen, how the fuck do we have Mike Milligan, right? It's like they backed themselves into sort of a corner here.
Yeah, I mean, like, is Mike Milligan to come back, kill literally everyone on both sides of this war and rebuild everything with Ebel and Joe Bulow? Like, I don't know. I was honestly shocked to see it. And I can see, like, they even do some visual stuff interesting that, like, he's walking away and there's this wide shot and the skies look real stormy, almost tornado-like. Like, I do kind of, I made that as a joke, but I do think that he's going to come back and, like, execute some people.
I mean, it might be like a nice capper to this idea of family and loyalty, right? And, like, the idea that Loy has traded off his son, who then comes back and says, nah, fuck everybody, including you, Dad.
Yeah, this is my world. Yeah. I am the boss. Like, fuck you, Dad. Fuck you, this other guy. Like,
be a good cap, I think, maybe.
Yeah, and they've already told the stories of how, like, an 11-year-old kid can become, like, this vital cog in this ruthless fascist machine.
True.
So, like, I do think that that's the story. But, like, my mind is like, I don't know that I want to see Satchel coming in and just, like, regulating. You know? It's sad. It's very sad to see what he was four episodes ago versus what he's becoming now.
That's the thing. The turn has been so radical here. Like, going from Satchel to Mike Milligan in the span of one hotel scene. Like,
but we're supposed to understand that, like, is he the Rosetta Stone? You're supposed to understand Gaetano through too. That, like, this it can happen just like that. You can be an 11-year-old obsessed with a big-breasted 13-year-old, and then now you are a year later in Italy serving under, Il Duce and part of his death squads. Like, yeah, life is fucked up sometimes. But we'll see. We'll see. Like I said, I thought we were just going to see him in season two of Fargo.
Yeah.
Apparently, he has got some more roles to play. Which brings us to the Smutney business. We have like Satchel shares a scene, which I thought was interesting. They cut the scene of kind of upbeat tempo song about God Almighty cutting people down that deserve it. Like, you know, you get away and you think you run away free, but like, you know, the scales of justice will eventually be balanced. And it's Satchel walking down a dusty road. And it's Ethel Rita looking into the many deaths of Nurse Mayflower, going to the library, making these connections. I honestly don't know what connection is being made here, but
it's the ring.
Well, but that's what I'm saying. Like, I still don't know exactly why her eyes and Lloyd's light up at the end of the season. Like, I don't think this is literally going to be like an Indiana Jones and the Raiders of the Lost Ark, where like Belloc, she's going to run in there like Belloc holding up this ring with all the Fadas, and they all like kneel down and follow her now, like some gold idol. But
I think I have some explanations as to what is probably going to happen or what could potentially make a difference, but we'll talk about that.
Do you want to talk? Okay. Say. Yeah. So the other cool scene is Ethel Rita and Debril finally sit down and talk about the family curse.
Yeah.
And we find out that this Mr. Snowman was the captain of a slave ship, which her great great granddaddy murdered at sea one night. And I guess this was like one of those, handful of slave rebellion on a ship kind of stories we've heard somehow make it to America. But this guy's name's Theodore Roach. His eyes are sewn shut. He's got a wooden nose. I don't know if these are all posthumous. Like, surely the eyes stitched together are posthumous things. But the wooden nose, maybe he had that in life. Mm-hmm. And she explains he's been with him ever since. And there's like the stench that comes with him, the smell of low tide. And you've ever been to a beach, you kind of know that smell. The twisting and creaking of ropes and of the cordage of a ship at sea. The wind of a storm kind of like heralds him. And this is all important because I don't think we knew this information before this episode. And Ethel Rita asks if you can be rid of this guy. And it's an interesting response because she said your aunt tried to take him. Like, well, I'm the crazy criminal outlaw anyway. I might as well have the ghost. But he's more attracted to sunshine than darkness, mm-hmm. which explains his fixation with Ethel Rita, you know?
Yeah.
Lemuel comes out and explains that there's a ton of merchandise in the home, and he's going to be staying here. I feel like this is an assignment he's taken on himself. Like, Lloyd's not saying, hey, kid, I need you to stay here. He's probably got other dudes, but it'll be important later on, you know. Nurse Mayflower picks this opportunity out of the last 4 months to come blow up Ethel Rita's spot about this ring.
Yeah.
What do you think about all this?
I liked it. I like getting a little more information about their backstory, about what, you know, this Roach / Snowflake guy could be. We've been asking that question all season long. Literally, he was in episode one, and now here we are 9 episodes later, finally getting some backstory, and I appreciated it. And I thought, man, Lemuel is just like the smooth operator, and he tries to like, you know, when Orietta approaches, he goes up to her and he's like, hey, I'm Lemuel, like tries to introduce himself and be all cool and nice. And then things turn. And I liked the progression there where he's like more insistently, you need to leave. You need to get out of here. You know, as she's saying these terrible things, this scene works really well for me.
I think so, too. And there's something like poignant in the way that, you know, Orietta Mayflower, who is a terrible person mm-hmm. on very many accounts, still thinks she's better.
Yeah.
Still thinks she's better than Ethel Rita. And it's based like, and thinks she's her better. And it's, and like, I love how Ethel Rita continues to calmly and smoothly point out that, like, oh, you think I'm going to a place in hell? Is it above or below the place where they put you, who's murdered dozens of not just innocent, because I don't know, is Fada innocent? But helpless people, you know, people in trust, like that's, you know, I feel like we treat these crimes of fiduciary trust breaches more severely because it's like, you know, It's one thing if you're just walking down the road and someone confident scams you. But like when you're relying on them, like when you're a baby or you're an old person, you're a sick or injured person that cannot speak for yourself and cannot, you know, protect yourself to take advantage of that situation. We kind of reserve that. It's the lowest of the low, you know. But she still thinks she's better than Lemuel and Ethelreda. It's pretty incredible. Mm-hmm. So later that night, she decides she's going to come back with a hot shot to give Ethelreda and put her under once and for all. Mr. Snowman stops her. Well, at least scares the shit out of her, makes her run screaming into the night.
Yeah.
Right into the arms of the police that arrest her. 4 months later, Dr. Harvard's finally woken up out of his coma, identified her as the suspect, and she's going down. What do you think is in her purse that's her salvation?
I was wondering if it was like some kind of concoction she whipped up in case she was ever caught so she could put an end to herself. I don't know.
More macaroons. Got a macaroon for all you boys. You guys have been working hard investigating this crime. It's all misunderstanding. Let's all end it with some almond flavored sweets.
Yeah.
I did wonder if she's going to try to contact Josto somehow.
Maybe. I don't know what her purse does for that. It's not like her cell phone's going to be in, right?
No, but like she's got an address book or a phone number or a way to reach him or something. I don't know. I don't know why she wanted her purse. It's just, it's weird. And it's also kind of got like a little history of Fargo of like some of the main villains falling apart when the police, you know, like I was thinking of William H. Macy trying to crawl out the back window of the hotel in his underwear. Like it's, oh, you just need a minute. Oh, okay. Yeah. It's all falls apart.
Yeah.
And then all Smutney's are out on the front porch with the mule enjoying the show of her being taken away. Do you want to talk? Okay. What do you think about Mr.? Because I've been calling this, and it's not like I had any special insight. It's like a lot of times I just feel like, well, what do you expect to happen and what's your basic inversion? You expect this guy to be scary, you know, haunting. It's a curse. They're telling you it's a curse. But what if he's actually good? You know, and this is not, you see this from time to time. You think a ghostly presence is bad and it turns out he's actually good. How did you feel about this twist, or is it a twist?
I'm still not sure what to think. Why would this spirit of someone who is murdered by this family's ancestors be not haunting them, but somehow hovering around them, supporting them? Why would that be a thing?
I guess.
What am I missing?
I want to believe that a ghost, and maybe he started off vengeful, that haunts a family for 150 years and sees all their trials and tribulations and is forced to. Like, he can't turn away, right? Like, as these generations go on and these people are continually shit upon, recognizing his role in it all, feels bad and is trying to do something to move on to the next plane, atone in some way. I'd like to think if you took any racist person and you made him watch like a family of African Americans for 200 years, are they still going to be the exact same racist that they were 200 years ago? Like, you know, do what kind of ghost is he? Does he have a memory? Can he learn new things? Is he just like...
Right. My preconception of the ghost is that they are stuck. Like, there's a particular issue, reason why they're haunting you, and they're fixated on that until they're banished somehow. Maybe this is a more evolved ghost, you know? Maybe there's a different kind of ghost.
And also, maybe he's motivated. If you're stuck on Earth and, like, you can't move on unless you right some wrong, and your wrong is the North Atlantic slave trade, then you're going to be fucking stuck in America for a good long shit. Yeah. I don't know, the 100 years you'll be able to evaporate off this plane, dude. You know, you're here for the long run. The other idea is he's a vengeful ghost, and he's actually there because he was smiling. He wasn't like, you know, no, don't kill this girl. Like, he might take special glee in snuffing out the beautiful flowers that this family is able to grow despite all of their setbacks, right? And he's like there, like kind of like anticipating her death, and Oriette is put off by the fact that, you know, he looks like a vengeful hate ghost, and he accidentally runs her off and saves her, which I also think is a kind of a neat little coda for this ghost story.
Yeah.
Do you think we're done with it? Because that's the other thing, is like, I also feel like it's a little anticlimactic, either one of those explanations.
Yeah,
like there needs to be one more thing.
Maybe giving Ethelreda the opportunity to get the cannons off her back, her family's back, is capper enough for that ghost.
Well, the ghost took interest in Lemuel. I think that hasn't paid off yet.
Oh,
and
true.
I also think there's like, and they also keep Satchel. I also think it would be an interesting possibility to see like a Mike Milligan walking off with this ghost following him now. Now, I don't know what the, how that informs season two of Fargo. Like, if you imagine like Mr. Family. Snowman, it's not, but they also introduced this transitive property with Happy. Like, you know, sometimes bonds can be as strong for, you know, be as strong as family, more important than family.
And if you want to say that, like, maybe the it latching onto Lemuel is sort of a forecast of Ethelreda and Lemuel's relationship in the future. Maybe, you know, they get married and then Satchel would be related to Ethelreda and he would, Mike Milligan might inherit the ghost.
Their family. There you go.
Right.
Get into a new family branch.
I don't know.
Boy howdy. We take this season, we stuff a Wizard of the Oz episode and a ghost story into it all in one piece. Like, whew, it's a lot. It's a lot. I feel like early in the evening on Thanksgiving, I shouldn't have gone back for that second helping of turkey. Oh, what was I thinking?
There's another pie ready to come out.
There's another pie and all those deviled eggs are in the fridge. I know they are. I can't stop. Holly's gone mad with tryptophan this year. He just can't stop. He can't stop stuffing.
Yeah.
Can't stop, won't stop. So the final scene is Ethelreda with the grand bargain she offers Loy. And at first, Loy, you know, I'm only taking this meeting because my son said I should. I dismiss you as a girl. She does, she did all the research I tried to do on this summary execution of the Moorish kings. Is able to impress him with his knowledge of art and language and convince him that she's not just some girl, that she's got some. And she produces the ring and hands it to him. And somehow he knows what this ring can do. She smiles like she knows what this ring can do. I don't know what this ring can do. You have some ideas. Spill them.
Okay. Here's my semi-far-fetched idea on what this ring could lead to. So we've seen Ebel very, very put off by the actions of Josto, right? Throughout the last few episodes, like it really started when he said that Satchel was dead and was trying to get Gaetano killed. Ebel has sort of gone off and done his own thing, and maybe, you know, he's helping with this war because he's getting New York through Joe Bulo or whatever. But I think there's a lot of tension there, and Ebel might be interested in just wiping the slate clean, wiping the board clean here and getting rid of Josto as well. And if they can get to Ebel and say, hey, Josto ordered a hit, essentially, on Donatello by having proof of this nurse had his ring, it's tenuous. It's really, really loosely connected.
But Ethelreda also knows they have a romantic relationship.
Right.
But
How do you prove that to Ebel? And like, how do you say, well, the nurse didn't just act on her own and take this ring? She has a history of murdering unconnected people. So why wouldn't she just be acting on her own? Like, connecting this to Josto directly is very tenuous, in my opinion. But
would you say it's messy? Would you say those connections are messy and fudged and indistinct? Yeah, yeah.
For sure. But can they convince Ebel of it, I guess, is the question. And will Ebel then go
call,
like, look, he's a loose cannon that we need to get rid of, and I'll just take over. And New York can take over, right?
New York can be like, all right, we're calling this. And you know what? Who's the tallest guy here? Joe Bulo. You're running this thing now.
Right. So I could see it. You have to squint, but you can definitely see a path to victory here. You know, and then I fully believe that, like, Cannon and the Loy and Ebel could broker some kind of truce or deal here that ends this war.
Yeah, I think that feels right to me. Like if you can, and that's the other really delicious irony is that Josto would go down, and that, you know, this goes back to the core of the debates we've had many times over the last few weeks. Did Josto order the hit?
Right.
You know, some people say absolutely he did. He knew that he was doing the mafia double talk a lot. But my position's always been, it's deliberately been left up to interpretation. And now that you've said this, I think this is the way it comes back. Because there's enough there that, like, I think about also that scene in Casino we just covered for its 30-year anniversary, where all the old guys are debating who's loyal, and they're all like, "Oh, this guy's solid. He won't fold on us. He's been a faith. Yeah, he's a Marine. You can count on him. Yeah, I think he's pretty good." And he goes all the way to the end of the table, and the old guy's like, "You know, my way of thinking is, why take the chance?"
Yeah,
and I feel like that Josto will be that guy who the old guys are just not willing to take a chance on. Now that Gaetano, sure. Now that, like, it looks like Gaetano, also Gaetano's, it looks like he got murdered, like,
yeah,
executed.
He does.
Outside this hit that we know was the Fadas, dude. So it's like, I think that all these things are going to pile up, and you're right. Ebel's the one that also in this gang still has a little bit of, fond memories over Dr. Senator, kind of respected the operation, like, from an intellectual and, like, almost a fraternal way. Like, him and Dr. Senator was simpatico. That makes a lot of sense. It is messy.
Yeah. Yeah, well, but I mean, with Josto trying to kill Gaetano right in front of Ebel, right? Like, he has thrown him under the bus and said, like, lied about Satchel being dead in order to get Gaetano killed, and specifically asked Lloyd to kill him in exchange.
And who's going to believe this? Oh, your brother slipped and tripped and shot himself in the head,
right,
when there's no witnesses?
It's so ridiculous.
Yeah.
Yeah, you were the only one there. Why are the bosses on the hit anyway?
Yeah. Why did you pay this? Why did you have this nurse kill the old man too? Like, there's a lot of questions, and what the mafia is not known for? Due process.
Right.
You know, if he got his chance in a court of law, maybe he could clear himself. I don't think he's going to get that chance, Jim.
I don't think so either.
I don't think there's going to be any law and order at this late stage. Anything else to talk about? Because that's the episode of Fargo.
I did want to say, on the episode where Gaetano goes out, I noticed this episode. Gaetano has the face of one of those pinball machines, which has, like, the two sets of flippers, one at the top, one at the bottom. If you look at his eyebrows and his mustache, that's it. That's what it is. He has a pinball machine face. That's all I wanted to say. I couldn't help but notice it.
Pinbot 2000.
Hell yeah.
Sure. Okay. I don't see it. I have to watch the episode again and see if it jumps out at me.
Yeah.
FX is adapting James Clavell's best-selling novel, Shogun, into a 10-part miniseries this spring. Set in the shogunate period of Japan at the turn of the 15th century, Shogun depicts the rise of a feudal lord to Shogun, as seen through the eyes of a shipwrecked English sailor. It's loosely based on the real-life exploits of William Adams and Tokugawa Ieyasu.
Shogun has already been successfully adapted back in 1980 with a widely acclaimed miniseries starring Richard Chamberlain, featuring intricate plots, political scheming, complex characters, and thrilling action. This time, husband and wife team Justin Marks and Rachel Kondo try to recapture the successes of the novel and early adaptations while increasing the levels of historical and cultural accuracy that are often perceived as flaws of this and similar works.
Starring Hiroyuki Sanada from The Last Samurai, Mortal Kombat, and John Wick 4, with Cosmo Jarvis of Peaky Blinders, Raised by Wolves, etc., joining the truly massive cast required to bring this complex world to life. Join Aaron and I each week as we deep dive into each episode, uncovering the mysteries, the intrigue, and the glory of Shogun.
Shogun premieres on FX Hulu Tuesday, February 27th, at the two-part debut. Our podcast will release each Thursday thereafter. Get our Shogun coverage by searching for Bald Move Prestige in your favorite podcast app.
Hey, it's time for another season of Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? The premise is simple. A Gen Xer and a millennial watch old 80s action TV to see what still works and what doesn't. In previous seasons, we've done podcasts for Knight Rider, Airwolf, MacGyver, A-Team, and more. However, this year we're doing a very special season of Feeny. We're going back and reviewing the very special episodes of 80s and 90s sitcoms. Come cringe along with us as Hollywood tries to warn our families of the dangers of underage smoking, drug abuse, alcoholism, eating disorders, and much more. We start out with the episode of Boy Meets World where a high school kid gets sucked into a cult. Worlds collide as the Mr. Feeny finally makes an appearance on Why Is Mr. Feeny a Car? Join me and my buddy Jay each week for episodes full of nostalgia and secondhand embarrassment. And don't worry, if Very Special isn't your speed, we've also got some all-time classic Knight Rider episodes to close the season with. Find Why Is Mr. Feeny a Car? Each Wednesday on Bald Move Pulp, starting April 3rd.
All right, it's time to consider feedback for our Fargo podcast, because that's what we do here. Fargo@baldmove.com is how you send it. You can also discuss it with your fellow fans on our forums, forums.baldmove.com. One note is there is one more episode, of course, you can get your feedback on. We also will be coming back after that last episode, the week after, with a Fargo wrap-up podcast, which I'm hoping to get some answers as far as, like, you know, have some juicy quotes from Holly about the things went right and the things went wrong and the things maybe he could have changed, because, you know, he usually does those things, and it'll be exciting to read. And if you got any final feedback, send it in to fargo@baldmove.com. Remember, there will be a wrap-up podcast this year. Okay, first up, Brandon in the Mitten said, I have some thoughts on the latest black and white episode of Fargo. This is, of course, the Wizard of Oz from the previous week. What a fantastic, quirky ride it was. The Wizard of Oz connections continue, though I'm not really sure what the purpose of it all is. Also, do you think it's possible the rabbi and Kalamita are still alive? You always hear stories about people surviving in the eye of Twisters. Not sure if those are folk tales, but considering Fargo's habit of having improbable things occur in key moments, I'm not ruling out rabbi swooping in to save Satchel or Loy in the last minute.
It's been 4 months. I doubt it.
Yeah, I mean, that's the problem with sending in the feedback in a previous episode. Yeah, Rabbi, yeah, Kalamita, maybe, but like, narratively, I just don't see it happening, and how that would be important, like, with the time jump, because I don't think anybody saw the time jump coming. Mm-hmm. So, moving on to Justin P. from San Francisco, love your work and often find myself watching shows I wouldn't otherwise watch. Well, thank you, Justin. I have two things to add, one inconsequential, maybe even borderline pedantic, and other relevant to your current state of political, or our current state of political affairs. First, Jim referenced a specific character from The Wizard of Oz who was the gold standard opponent. I'm pretty sure it's based on William Jennings Bryan, who in the late 1890s gave a famous speech known as the Cross of the Gold speech, where he decried the gold standard. Just a bit of trivia for the future. Finally, you mentioned the episode that pederasty is the one thing the left and right can agree upon. But I'm afraid it's still not true. During the Alabama 2017 special Senate session to fill Jeff Sessions' Senate seat, he vacated to take the Trump administration attorney general post, Doug Jones versus Roy Moore. It was revealed that Judge Moore had a very clear history of preying on young teenage girls, and the right wing rallied behind Roy Moore because they believed even a child sexual predator was a better choice than a very conservative Democrat. He lost. But it was a pretty fucking close election, you know, guy who dates 13 to 16 year olds versus guy who personally shut down the Ku Klux Klan. Whew, tough choice, Alabama. Anyway, so I think that's kind of perversely evidenced, because he would have won in a landslide had that allegation kind of come to light. That's still something we agree. Pedophiles is bad, but I don't know. In the margins, it's gross. He also said he's a recent club member, and maybe other people have this problem too, but they want to figure out how to get content, that club content, into your iPhone. It's actually real easy. If you go to baldmove.com and then you log in, there is a bar for premium features, and under that there is what's called the podcast subscription tool.
Yep.
And you click on that and allows you to, build the copy and paste thing you need to put in your particular podcast app. We have one for iPhone. We have one for a lot of them, and a generic one that works for almost all the others. So it's real easy. Just use that tool. It takes about 30 seconds to the punch it into your favorite podcast app. And then you got your premium commercial free goodness. David H., I always look forward to your takes on my favorite shows. Well, thanks, David. I think Chekhov's knife shows up when Mike Milligan stabs the Undertaker in season 2. I guess he's talking about
Chekhov's knife being the knife that you know, the stabbing lessons that Rabbi gives to Mike, to Satchel slash Mike Milligan.
Okay.
Yeah, no, you're not wrong. You're not wrong. It's a wild Chekhov's gun. It's a time traveling Chekhov's knife.
Love it.
Back 5 years and two seasons ago. But 30 years into this show's future.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, if that's intentional and if that's, yeah, if they meant that, that's really cool, actually.
Yeah, you gotta get fucking Doctor Who involved writing the scripts at this point. Yeah. David continues, maybe I'm reading a bit too much into it, but the future is now sign looks like an advertisement for the suburbs. What goes along with suburbs is white flight, home goods stores, and color television. Rabbi Milligan has truly delivered Satchel to the future, but is frustrated and lost in it. That's a good take.
It's like Dark. Remember that sign that's out front of the fucking power plant or whatever?
The power plant. Yeah. Yeah. No, that's a pretty good take. You're right. The suburbs are known for, I mean, there's a lot of stuff. Sprawl, the fact that it solidified and cemented the fact that America, you have to have a car to do anything or get anywhere in this country. And also, yeah, white flight. Getting out of this, you know, getting out of the cities. Because, you know, who lives in the cities? People. And you don't want to be around them.
Americans,
yeah,
no, it's, live in the city.
Yeah, yeah, exactly, exactly. Forgotten that along the way somehow. Mm-hmm. But that's a really good take. I appreciate that. Regarding Yertle the Turtle, I doubt that Dr. Seuss adapted it from a fable. I don't think that was the style. However, Yertle was originally drawn with a square little Hitler mustache. During the pre-war years, Seuss drew political cartoons for a socialist magazine. He took shots at Hitler and other rising fascist dictatorships. I did know that. I think that, like, I don't know, man, because I've seen people, like, tear down Dr. Seuss. I've also seen people laud Dr. Seuss for some of his views on anti-Semitism. I think the deal is maybe he started off anti-Semitic and then was talked out of it later on. But yeah, I don't know. I don't have a dog in a fight about Yertle the Turtle. I just thought it's plausible that it was adapted. I was trying to find a way to make Mark Fargo not be stealing, you know, 4 or 5 years before something became a thing. Maybe that Italian guy is the one who gave Dr. Seuss the idea. Yeah, he was a secret Italian socialist, wrote in fan mail. Hey, have you ever thought about this turtle situation and how much Hitler's just like him?
That sounds right to me. That sounds definitely correct. But the only thing I know less about than Wizard of Oz is Dr. Seuss. So
right. Here's one I feel bad for because it was titled Challenge Accepted. It's from Tommy in North Carolina. And he says, Aaron mentioned bluebirds, rainbows, tornadoes, dogs and picnic baskets and melting witches. I'm not sure if I specifically challenged our listeners to come up with a song or a limerick that incorporates all these things. If I did... Tommy won. Here's his sample. Five bluebirds in a feeder in November. And I just have to say, folks, remember, climate change is real. It's a big fucking deal. And the bluebirds have decided to overwinter. There's many a holly twist in Fargo, not the least Omi's surprise cargo. But that doesn't explain. So the question remains, will there ever be rainbows in Fargo? The Midwest is filled with untethered and apparently unpredictable weather, so along comes a wind that's liable to end both villains and heroes together. A miracle took place, not from outer space, and like a shot from Sin City, and less is the pity, that witch takes a house to the face. Satchel's Mike Milligan, not a spoiler, and now we go back to the KC pot boiler, but I hope little Mike buttons his jacket and survives Whitey's KC racket, but for now, Rabbit ain't got no picnic basket. They probably all end up in a ditch, like we say, life's a bitch. But a simple bucket of water from an earnest farmer's daughter melted real good that cranky witch. So there you go.
All right. I like it.
It's whatever challenge I issued, you have bested it. And I don't know what it is about Tom's and Bald Move, but like they tend towards poetry.
Mm-hmm.
Remember Tom and Volkswagen?
Sure.
He was our poet laureate. Yeah. And now we got Tommy from North Carolina coming to take the belt. Thank you for that. Let's move on to Stephen S. Hey, I'm a new listener to your podcast. I really enjoy it. I really look forward to your podcast as much as I look forward to Fargo. That's high praise. Wow. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
In the East-West episode, there's a couple of scenes that you glossed over and mentioned them seemingly as insignificant. In my opinion, they were very powerful scenes. I'm talking about the scene where Satchel and the rabbi meet the lady at the front desk and the rabbi robbed the Indiana brothers. These scenes were significant for the message of racism that Holly is driving home this season. For example, the front desk lady casually talks about the sisters not liking black people. Meanwhile, she's employed by them. As a person of color, Native American, Mexican in this case, I can tell you this absolutely happens. People assume that hiring minorities is a sign that someone is not racist. That is obviously not true, but many people either purposely or naively use it as a shield. Then when the rabbi is committing a violent crime, the officer is tied up harassing an innocent black kid. This points to another thing that happens. The amount of time spent profiling takes away from cops actually being able to protect and serve.
Yeah, it's like the, oh, I got a black friend statement.
Yeah. Know? Yeah. That's, or I can't be racist. I dated a black person once. Or, you know, I hired one. I voted for Barack Obama. I cannot possibly sure. be. There's actually, I talk about this on a Three Right Turns podcast, but there's a well-studied phenomenon called moral license, where a person that does one thing is perceived as virtuous, then lets them, like, for example, I, for the last 3 days, kept my diet. So tonight I'm going to eat a whole chocolate cake.
Yeah.
Or I voted for that black president the one time. So now I'm going to really lean first in this anti-immigrant American first because I can't possibly be racist. I've already proved it. It actually kind of rebounds kind of like it allows society to like rebound in ugly ways. It's it's an interesting form of mental bias, like a lot of these things are. He also continues in an admonishment to me. He says, P.S. Please stop calling Native Americans Indians. We call ourselves that, but that's really the only time it's appropriate. If you must say Indian, at least say American Indian. If you have any listeners who are currently of Indian descent, you may be mildly offending two different cultures. As a Native American, Lakota to be exact, calling us Indians is a very minor offense to me. Hey, I'm sorry. I don't mean to do that. Sometimes this gets me in trouble in shows. Like for Westworld, I try to conscientiously observe, like refer to people who do sex work as sex workers, because I don't want to demean people that are doing those jobs and have a hard enough problem. But when I'm watching Westworld or when I'm talking about Game of Thrones, what freely refers and to people as whores, and the sex workers themselves refer to themselves as that, I sometimes go along with that rhetorically in the show. And sometimes I think that that's happened this season because people are freely referring to Native Americans as Indians. They themselves are doing it. And, you know, I kind of get swept along in that. And that's not even swept along. It's a conscious choice to like take the material. Yeah. But, you know, it's a fair criticism because like I for damn sure if I was doing like Huckleberry Finn, I wouldn't be referring to Jim as N-word Jim just because I'm going along. So like there's probably a little thing I need to work on there. But yeah, I'm sorry. I'll try to figure out how to do that better in the future. Whitney in Philadelphia. Hey guys, maybe I'm slow, but before the final episode, please tell me how Loy, holding the ring ends the war. Why are they both smiling at the end? I don't know. Were you persuaded by the Jim? Cause I left this in because I'm with you. I'm like, oh, we'll have a rip roaring discussion about that. But I think Jim's got a good idea there.
Yeah, I mean, I had to sit down and think about it. Like, this is one of those things where I was like, oh God, I don't get the end of this episode. I don't know why it helps them at all after watching this the first time. And then, yeah, I had to like sit down and think, what possible help could this be? And I think it was like the Ebel connection is what really solidified it for me.
Also, before the final episode, please explain what and why, what why clues lead you to believe that Satchel is Mike Milligan. For a moment, I thought that Red Truck was going to have mute twins in the back, and since it had the menacing racists with that guns of their own, I'm lost of why you guys had originally thought that.
This seems to be like a pet theory that the subreddit, especially probably internet at large, has latched onto. I think it's right, but it's really more of a feeling than it is anything. Like, especially up until now, you know, when he turned the corner and was like, "This is my fucking world, fuck off." It was real, real thin, based on the rabbi having the last name Milligan, the Casey Mafia being, you know, related to Mike Milligan in the future and him working for them, and this all taking place in Kansas City. It was like, okay, I can see it. but nothing like concrete, I don't think, has really been.
And you know, the big thing is like also Mike Milligan's black, Satchel's black.
Sure, yeah.
How does a young brash man like Mike Milligan rise so far and in such a trusted role in the 1970s, which, you know, I think 2020 America is still pretty racist. 1970s America was racist. 1950s America is racist. Like, you know, like it's the arrow of progress points forward, not back. So it was like, you know, how do you explain? I remember that even being kind of talked as kind of like a weird piece of exceptionalism. Like, you know, like either Mike Milligan is like a really, really, really fucking good gangster to where he's a, you know, gotten across all that prejudice and racism within the mafia and within this area of the country in particular, which I think that's also true. But also,
yeah,
you know, he might have a little in here and that Mike he Milligan. Was maybe instrument.
Can Mike Milligan be described as a Mary Sue without this connection here?
I don't know.
Like he's so good at his job. He's like, doesn't make I don't know.
Because he also has a lot of flaws. He also, if I recall, has sure. as particular and peculiar flaws as well.
It's been a while.
Non-hallmark of a Mary Sue.
Right.
So I think that's like, it's again, it's like, it's all circumstantial. And it's also not, I don't think, really important. In just the same way that like Joe Bulo, like, you know, I guess that's a little different because they're actually the guy's name and he, you know, but
and that's but a like, connection for Mike Milligan too, right? That Joe Bulo is directly involved here in this season. You could say, oh, by extension,
right.
They might have Mike Milligan directly involved. The ages work out, that kind of thing.
The age would work out. Yeah. Yeah. Pretty beautifully as well. And just kind of like also, especially after when we talked about this last week, but in the Wizard of Oz episode, you know, him meeting that guy who does tin siding with the how to win friends and influence people. Like, that's very Mike Milligan.
Yeah.
Very. Like, that guy's, like, vocal patterns and the way he talked to people and all that stuff is very, very Mike Milligan. So, it's like I said, it's all circumstantial. There's never been, like, drawing a picture of Satchel and, like, M. Milligan, you know, rap sheet kind of. Like, it's never been, but it also seems like definitely what they're alluding to. Whitney concludes, finally, I don't like anyone on this series, and that's never happened in Fargo before. I tend to like good guys and bad guys alike, but here everyone's annoying. When Linda Nygaard, for example, told of her past and was then murdered, I thought it was sad, but I also thought it was an effective speech and trauma to go along with it. With Gaetano's 11-year-old with a massive desire, quote-unquote, it was just weird and off-putting to me. Anyway, thanks so much for covering your show. I wish you had done Undoing. I missed you guys. I've not even heard of Undoing. I think it's weird that you go with an 11-year-old having sex for the first time, almost getting murdered and then murdering someone. Mm-hmm. You know, there could have been maybe something a little bit more 11-year-old and sympathetic, but yeah, like I said before, I think that that's fucked up, you know? Like, there's a lot of things that they've hinted at this season of being fucked up that haven't come out and write and say it, like the Milligan being a child molester of his own kids and other people's kids. I wonder if they're trying to do some kind of like early sexualization trauma thing here.
How old is Vito's wife supposed to be in The Godfather when he marries her in Sicily or whatever? Isn't she like super young? Isn't she like 13 or?
I know Michael for sure. His Italian wife was like,
was it Michael?
Was she 14 okay, or 15? That gets blown up in the car.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Okay. It's Michael's wife. Yeah. Not Vito's. Yeah. So maybe they're leaning into that. Maybe Holly's like, oh, well, they, you know, have super young brides, which means super young sex and super young feelings and thoughts.
It is weird and off-putting. But everything else about the war, like, you know, 11-year-old being on a death squad, you know, or even a 13, 14-year-old is pretty fucking horrific. It is weird that they leaned into the, oh, my first sexual experience as 11 and already strong as ox. Like, I don't know. That's on the early side, but, you know, maybe he's an early bloomer.
Sure.
Yeah, it's weird. I'm not going to try to talk you out of that opinion. And you're not alone, Whitney. Like, a lot of, like, Dr. Senator. Really,
He's the best, right? The best of all of them.
He's the best of all of them. I really want to like Loy Cannon, and I kept on looking for him to be this criminal genius, but I just don't feel like that's worth the writing. He's just, he's not, he's a decent guy, by criminal reckonings.
Mm-hmm.
He holds the code and he keeps his word. And he's pretty adamant, but like he doesn't have like these really intense, crazy plots. Like they are always kind of on the surface. And I'm kind of with you. And like as much as I want to like Ethelreda, and I do like her, she's gone from crucial sections of this season. And I feel like they could have told this story a little bit better and had her have a little bit more of an organic, because I felt like every single time she appears on the scene, she's moving plot forward, like literally. And that's a lot to put on this character's shoulders, especially when she's like a pseudo main character. So
It's just those series of subversions I talked about earlier make everybody look weak and therefore dumb. And I don't know, like Loy Cannon, like I don't think he's a dumb guy. I think he's got a lot of smarts, a lot of the correct ideas, and the plays that he's making are just constantly subverted. Like he tries to make this play with Wef, it doesn't go anywhere. He tries to make this play by releasing Gaetano, getting him to kill Giusto. It does backfires on him. Like all of the things that he tries that are actually really very smart are subverted by the writing of the rest of the season, and that makes it feel super dissatisfying, both on a plot level for me, and then also for you as an emailer on a character level. So
I agree.
That's rough.
Let's move on to Matt McF regarding the ninja nurse. Hey guys, I'm enjoying this season for the most part, but a real head scratcher for me is Orietta. How could a woman that seems to have problem bending her knees make her way through a locked door, past the sleeping Lemuel, up the stairs, and into Mary Sue's, Ethelreda's bedroom?
Okay, there's your
scream.
Real Mary Sue.
Then back out of the room, get past Lemuel with the shotgun, and back to her place with all sorts of skills, with the sorts of skills that she wouldn't have needed to poison Dr. Harvard. With those sorts of skills, she wouldn't have needed to poison him. She could have gotten his office easily. She might as well go with the cops. There's no way they can hold her.
Gotcha. Yeah, it's unbelievable. And that's why they don't show any of it. They just skip.
Yeah, like you imagine her, like what does her sneak stomp look like up the stairs? You know? That's a damn good question. I feel like if they had really leaned in her being like this super a supernatural, unstoppable evil force, which I thought they were doing early on in the season, then it would just like no one questions why. Billy Bob Thornton. Yeah, no one questions how and why Lorne Malvo can get out of a basement with no exits, how we can get into a restroom and cut the power, how we can do this, that, and the other. He just does, because he's a vaguely supernatural thing. They really went away from that and made her like, give her all the weird sex BDSM stuff and all these other layers and put a lot of human stuff on her that they never did with Malvo. So I don't know, but your timeline of events is hysterical. As for Ethelreda, I think she's a textbook Mary Sue. The flaw they could have given her perhaps is stressing out about the diary or journal that she left in the murder shrine, but nope, they completely gloss over that. And instead she walks into Loy's office and reminds us of how smart she is by speaking fluent French and knowing art history, and lays out a plan to save the family from the mob. Yeah, I agree with this criticism, too.
And I don't know that it's necessarily a bad thing to have a Mary Sue in your story. It is a trope, certainly. But, I mean, Fargo leans into a lot of archetypes, right? Like, the dumb criminal archetype is something they lean heavily into. I think you can do it, but, man, you got to do something original with it. And I don't think they did here.
Yeah, and like some people say, well, the defense of the Mary Sue is her flaws, that like no one really is on her side. Like everyone, like she's the best person on the show, but no one can see that. Not the school administrators, no one takes her seriously. That's not a counter intrication of Mary Sue. Mary Sue's a lot of times are unappreciated geniuses. Mm-hmm. That are not, they don't fit in and are not accepted by, because people don't appreciate their next level genius.
And if I'm being super generous, I would say that Holly wants to use the Mary Sue, in this case, a black girl, to drive home the point that no matter how intelligent and well put together and articulate you are as a black person, you're not going to be taken seriously, which is, the speech that Orietta gives her at the end of this episode. I that would be maybe not too generous. I think that is what they're doing. It's just like, is that enough?
Yeah, and also, like, if you're a white guy writing a young black girl, like, what flaw do you give her that feel that you would feel comfortable writing about? Like, you know, like, what's the thing that she's going to overcome? You know, like, oh God, she's a black woman living in this racially divided house in this back, you know, culturally backward spot in the Midwest, embroiled in a gang war. Like, okay, maybe she's got enough external threats and flaws and things that she's got just standing there. Like the she's in you know, waist deep, fast moving water, and it's miraculous that she's not being swept upstream. She doesn't need any more problems. She's stuck in this undercurrent, right? So yeah. I don't know. It's tough. Like I said, Holly bit off a lot trying to do this particular season and centered on so many different things in a way that, like, I think the Watchmen dodged all this by just, like, you know what this is about a particular thing and a particular people and how they deal with it, rather than let's also try to soften it by bringing these other perspectives and what they think and show. Like, it's a lot harder when you just laser in and focus on what the Watchmen was trying to do versus so many things that he's trying to do on here in Fargo. Last email from Furkanda from Chippewa, New York, says, the line that Nurse Orietta hisses to Ethel Rita, what does it feel like to be so sure you're right and know that nobody cares? It's been the plight of many black people in America, with the most recent protests illuminating how this mentality and reality is still permissive. This episode, though, is the first episode of the season that fell kind of flat for me. Nurse Orietta's interaction and dialogue was the highlight. The backstory of the ghost that haunts Ethel Rita's family was powerful but confusing. Roach was evil when he's alive. Is he a protector now? Why does he like sunlight? I don't know. Maybe some of the things I said were persuasive or explanatory on that. Hopefully. Gaetano's backstory I also found poignant. He's obviously suffering from PTSD, but shows signs of sadist behavior in the manner in which he protected himself from Adelina's father. When Josto says, you are here now, that's what every immigrant must remind themselves when the pain of what horrors immigrants have left behind creeps back into your mind. Yeah, imagine if you're from a war-torn country, for example, a refugee, and like what it must be like to, you know, a month ago be in a place is being shelled and now you're in a country that's safe. Like, what does that even mean? How does this country feel about you? What does relative safety mean? Those are all interesting points to pick out. And another thing that another big part of the big mouthful that we're trying to chew here, Happy carrying the pictures of his ancestors, slaves and sharecroppers, very powerful. So many of us have our own ancestors with us, or ghosts that follow us, haunting, warning and advising us. I'm a huge fan of your podcast and adore this series, and especially this season. This episode is a bit lacking, especially after watching East West last week, but I remain a huge fan. Glad we left Fargo and very happy to see this type of storyline with this wealth of characters and their complexions. I mean, that's where, like, I like Holly because he does try to do big things, both in terms of storytelling, in terms of the stories he's trying to tell. The things he's trying to tackle are difficult. Like in Legion, it's a superhero story, but it's really about mental illness. Mm-hmm. You know, this is a story about a gang war, but it's really about the melting pot of America. And what does that even mean? And I would much rather a guy do this kind of thing and occasionally fail or maybe not quite meet the mark than to just kind of play it safe and like, oh, let's just tell a traditional gang story because, you know, that's what Fargo's doing, right?
Sure. Yeah. Get behind that.
That's the email this week. Fargo@baldmove.com is how you send us, get in touch with us. Again, we'll have one more episode to discuss, and we will have a wrap-up episode. So 2 weeks left to get your feedback in. Fargo@baldmove.com. That wraps us up for this week. Until next time, I'm Aaron.
And I'm Jim.
See ya.